MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Well, he joins us on the radio on a Thursday afternoon, which is sort of different, but anyway, he wasn't well on Tuesday, and as I said, very popular regular guest is Dr. Ross Walker. He joins me on a Thursday afternoon, and thank you, Ross, for doing this.
Well, mate, I hope I can struggle through this. I might have to have the occasional cough. As you know, I had COVID about 5 or 6 weeks ago, got over it without any major issues, and then had a bit of a cough on Sunday night. And then Monday, my voice was very scratchy. Tuesday, I couldn't talk at all, which is why I couldn't do the segment. And the voice wasn't good enough to do it yesterday, and it's okay at the moment.
Is the voice the only symptoms you have? Is it just the voice?
Bad cough, feel lousy. Look, the point about all of this is we've become so COVID-obsessed. There are buckets of respiratory tract viruses around that have nothing to do with COVID.
Yeah.
So there's influenza, which I know I don't have. I flu vaccine and I have no symptoms of influenza. There's a thing called respiratory syncytial virus, which is a more significant version of respiratory tract infection that can really knock you around. It could be this, or it could just be a cold. I mean, I lose my voice every few years. I've said this to you on numerous occasions. We all have different immune systems. My immune system loves influenza and respiratory tract infections. Other people will say, never had a cold in my life.
Yeah.
That's because they have an immune system that responds better to respiratory tract infections than someone like myself. But then there are people who are prone to cold sores. I've never had a cold sore in my life. Whereas other people get cold sores very easily. That's the way they respond to the herpes simplex virus that causes a cold sore. So we're all different. We all react differently to things. And you just have to deal with them when they happen, which is what I'm doing at the moment.
Let's talk monkeypox. Now, There are more than 16,000 reported cases of monkeypox.
Oh, many more than that now, mate.
Now,
30,000.
30,000 now, right.
Yep.
So that's within 75 countries and territories, they say. What is monkeypox, Ross?
Yeah, monkeypox comes from the group of viruses called orthopoxes. So we've heard so much about coronaviruses, which are things like COVID-19, SARS and MERS, whereas the orthopox viruses are really, the main one is smallpox, that's the one we've heard the most about, but also a thing called cowpox, and now this monkeypox. Now, chickenpox is a different type of virus, but they all come from a similar group of viruses. Now, this monkeypox is endemic, strangely, this will shock you, in monkeys. And also the giant pouched rats, which I know are amongst your favourite rats.
They are.
The African dormice and squirrels carry this endemically. It's been in Africa since 1958 in animals. The first human case was reported in the Congo in 1970. And the first monkeypox outside of Africa was in the US in 2003. So there's been a lot of monkeypox going on around for a long time, but we've never really had a mini epidemic like we're seeing now around the world. Now, typically, 98% of cases are in the gay community, men who sleep with men, and 95% of the cases are through sexual transmission. And typically, it presents like a normal virus: fever, headaches, back pain, bit of swelling of the lymph nodes, aches and pains in the muscles, and a reduction in energy. But then a few days into the illness, people start to get this pimply, blistery rash, which typically occurs on the face and in the mouth and on the soles and soles of the feet and the palms, a bit like chicken pox. Lasts for a week or so, and then tends to get better in most people. But it still can kill people. There's about a 3% death rate in this current outbreak. There is one antiviral that works for it, and the chickenpox vaccine, the smallpox vaccine and another vaccine can be used as preventatives as well. So we should be alert but not alarmed, as they say, about this. And if you're in a high-risk group, of course, we now have vaccines in Australia that people can have.
How does someone become infected, apart from the obvious?
Well, it's really if someone is infected by contact with another human being has had it now that there's this outbreak. I think there's around 100 cases in Australia at the moment, which out of a population of 25 million is not a huge amount. And if you're in the high-risk group, i.e. the gay community,
yeah,
then there is a possibility of catching it in that situation through sexual contact. But for the people who aren't in that environment, the risk of getting monkeypox is almost negligible.
Was it an overreaction by the Australian government to order 450,000 vials of the vaccine for monkeypox?
I would think so, but they're just being cautious. They don't want to get caught out as they were caught out with the COVID early on.
Yeah, true. But so far in Australia, as you said, there's only, what, how many, 100 cases of it?
About 100 cases,
cases of it. Yeah. So for the moment, it's not a major problem here. Let's hope it stays that way.
Absolutely.
Ross, if we can, let's talk about Alzheimer's disease, because there's new research out about Alzheimer's disease. And is it fair to say this new research could possibly change the way we think about Alzheimer's disease and what causes it?
Well, there are three aspects of this which are unrelated. The first is very disturbing. One of the world leading researchers in the area of Alzheimer's disease from the University of Minnesota in 2006 published data where he suggested that a thing called beta amyloid protein was the thing that directly caused Alzheimer's disease. And because of that, monoclonal antibodies were developed against this particular beta amyloid protein. And the FDA actually approved this aducanumab, which is the monoclonal antibody. And it was found that in people who were given this stuff, 40% of them actually had what we call cerebral edema or brain swelling. Now, just recently it's come out that this guy's published fraudulent research. He made it all up, which is quite disturbing. And in fact, some of the studies are suggesting that 10% of medical research published is fraudulent. Now, we do know, for example, there was a guy called Andrew Wakefield who many years ago published data suggesting there was a link between autism and the MMR vaccine. He made it up. But still, people believe this nonsense. If you speak to a lot of these anti-vaxxers with all the coronavirus vaccines, they will quote data from studies that have been made up by anti-vaxxers.
Yeah.
And they believe this nonsense. And so what I'm saying is whether it's research on vaccination or whether it's research on Alzheimer's disease, sometimes the research may be false. And that's a concern. So that's number one. So that has changed the way many of us think about Alzheimer's disease. Now, the beta amyloid protein may be involved, but I'm just saying this guy made up his research to heighten his argument that was the major cause. And unfortunately, a drug stemmed from that research, which has now been found to cause more harm than it's actually done good. Number one. Number two, a study that was published in the journal Communication Biology from Edith Cowan University in Western Australia showed that there's an interesting genetic link between Alzheimer's disease and several gut disorders. So the genes that may predispose you to Alzheimer's disease can also predispose you to very common gut problems such as reflux, peptic ulcer disease, irritable bowel syndrome, diverticular disease. And so what they're suggesting is, excuse me, I've got a cough.
You're right.
Seeing that there are common pathways with all of this very common diseases, that possibly by affecting one disease, you may be having benefits affecting another disease. So it's really looking at the gut microbiome and its potential link to all of these different diseases, including Alzheimer's disease. And then finally, another study out of Oxford University and Tufts University in the US, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, showed that common viruses, and viruses have been the talk of the town in medicine for the last 2.5 years, seem to trigger the onset of Alzheimer's disease. And it's interesting, there's an interplay between the chickenpox virus, the varicella zoster virus, and herpes simplex, which is the virus that causes the oral cold sores, and there's herpes simplex type 2, which causes genital herpes. But it seems that the varicella virus precipitates or activates the herpes simplex virus, which then can markedly increase the generation of plaques in the brain and thus cause Alzheimer's disease. So this is another reason why when you hit your mid-60s, you should go off and have your shingles vaccine, because if you can then suppress that, you may be suppressing the precipitation of the generation of Alzheimer's disease in your brain.
So would your advice be to everyone that's over the age of 60, go and get a shingles vaccine?
Yeah, it's free for people over the age of 70, so at least definitely everyone over the age of 70. But I think around 65, I'm going to have mine soon. I even though I've already had an episode of shingles, I think it's important to have the vaccinations up to date. And I think there are a whole lot of side benefits. So, for example, we spoke a few weeks ago about a study that showed people who have a yearly flu vaccine have up to a 45% reduction in heart attack. And the reason for that is because it stops the inflammation of influenza on your arteries by having that flu vaccine. So vaccination, in my view, and in the view of many people in medicine, was the greatest advance of last century in medicine. There is no doubt about that.
All right, to eat meat or not to eat meat. You wrote an article about this.
Oh, dear. Funny, I'm sure.
Plant-based meat hamburger.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of an oxymoron, isn't it? Plant-based meat, when you think about it. And I declared in the article incredible hypocrisy, because I am a committed carnivore.
Yes,
and I do enjoy my meat. And I say all the time, fish for therapy, meat for enjoyment.
I love that. Fish for therapy, meat for
enjoyment. And ladies and gentlemen, I will admit, I don't enjoy fish. I advise all my patients to eat fish, but I just don't like the taste. It makes me feel sick when I eat it. And I understand some people love it. But if I walk past a supermarket that has a fish section, I almost throw up from the smell. And some people love it. I just don't. But it is very, very good for people to eat it. I'm not being a hypocrite. I'm just being honest. But what this study out of the University of Bath did was look at 43 different studies into the health and environmental benefits of plant-based foods. And so I just thought there were some really interesting things. So in one study looking at German beef consumption, if they replace 5% of German beef consumption with pea protein, that's PEA, you reduce carbon dioxide emissions by about 8 million tonnes a year. If you replaced beef burgers with plant-based burgers, so the veggie burgers you can get anywhere, you reduce greenhouse gases by 98%. You use much less agricultural land using plants rather than cultivating animals, less water, less pollution, it's much healthier for you. And at an individual level, people who have plant-based meats and plant-based dairies have better weight loss and better muscle mass by doing it. And the good thing with the plant-based meats, which you can't do with animals, is you can add what we call functional foods. You can add the good bits of fungi, algae, and spirulina, which improves the micro and macronutrient content of the food. So there's, I think, unfortunately, we have 8 billion people on the planet. We just don't have the resources any longer to feed all of those 8 billion people, as we see from areas that are underdeveloped, that don't have enough food to keep people even above the poverty line. So I think we all have to start moving more towards plant-based foods. And if we can make them taste more like meat, which we're all used to eating, I think it'd be better for all of us.
And we get back to what you also mentioned in your article, and that is, you know, more fruit, more vegetable each and every day is ideally what we want to try and include in our regular diet anyway.
Yes, mate. And I mean, that's a great point. For those of us who do enjoy bits of meat and eggs and dairy and all those sort of things, that, still, it's the ones that have the two or three pieces of fruit per day, the 3 to 5 servings of vegetables, and that's less than 10% of the community. They are the healthiest people in the community. They have less cancer, less heart disease. Less than 10% do that simple thing, fruits and vegetables every day.
And what's your example that you give for a serving of vegetables? It's equivalent to?
Half a carrot.
There you go.
We're not talking about a huge amount of food. But if you have that, you're getting the strong, what we call polyphenols, which is just a scientific way of saying plant chemicals that have a profound effect on your health.
The Mediterranean diet.
Yeah, that's what it is.
I like to think you can combine both. If you have a hamburger, you can put some of those Mediterranean vegetables on the burger.
Yeah. All
yum.
All of the above.
You know, it will be good in the future if we can find a replacement for, let's talk about a hamburger patty. If they can come up with a hamburger patty that is not meat, but tastes like meat, looks like meat, for all intents and purposes, could be meat.
But this is what's happening in scientific laboratories around the world. They're now specifically formulated to replicate the taste, texture, and overall eating experience of animal products. So we're getting there.
Depression and low serotonin, you sort of put those two things together.
Yeah.
But apparently, low serotonin might not cause depression, Ross.
No, you see, I don't agree with this study. This was looking at 17 different studies of linking serotonin levels in the brain, serotonin levels in the bloodstream with depression. Now, that's ridiculous. You've got to look to where the problem is. The problem's in the brain, not in the bloodstream. And I make the analogy here with potassium. If you take a blood potassium level, that tells you nothing about your total body potassium, because most of the potassium is inside your cells. When you have a thought or an emotion, that thought is in microseconds. The transmission of serotonin across the synapse in the brain, you can't measure that in the bloodstream. So when they come out and say there's no link between serotonin and depression, what nonsense. Our antidepressants work by elevating the serotonin in the brain. Serotonin is one of the five happy chemicals, and it's the one that generates mood. So you look out the window, the birds are singing, the sun's shining. If you go, who cares? That's because your serotonin levels are low in the brain, not in your bloodstream. And interestingly, for all the conversations you and I have had over the years about the importance of the gut microbiome, 90% of our serotonin is made in the gut by our gut bacteria. So it's really important to have a healthy gut in terms of managing depression.
Yeah, well, it's really healthy to have it's really important to have a healthy gut for all sorts of things, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely.
Ross, I got to let you go. It's lovely. Thanks, mate. I know we're a couple of days late. You look after yourself and look after your voice. We'll be thinking of you and we'll catch you, Nick. I won't be here next week, but we'll hopefully catch up the week after.
When you get back, mate. All the best for you too.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks,
see
mate.
You, Ross.
Bye.
Bye-bye.